The headlines: Palestinians hail the UN top rights body's decision to launch a probe into crimes committed during the recent Israeli onslaught on Gaza. Japan extends a state of emergency in Tokyo and other areas as the COVID-19 pandemic shows no signs of abating less than 2 months before the Summer Olympics open. And more updates from Iran's upcoming presidential election campaign trail. Hello and welcome, everybody. The United Nations top rights body has agreed to launch an investigation into crimes committed during the recent Israeli onslaught on Gaza. Israel denounced the decision as shameful, while Palestinians welcomed the move. This report has more details.
The decision has been made. The United Nations Human Rights Council has agreed to launch an open-ended international investigation into crimes committed during the 11-day Israeli onslaught on the Gaza Strip. The probe will also include the systematic abuses in the Palestinian territories and inside Israel. The resolution, which passed with 24 votes in favor in the 47-member council, will spur an unprecedented level of scrutiny on abuses and their root causes in the decades-long conflict. Israeli airstrikes and artillery fire on Gaza killed 255 Palestinians, including 66 children, and wounded more than 1,900 people in 11 days of conflict before a ceasefire. UN Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet voiced particular concern over, quote, the high level of civilian fatalities and injuries from the Israeli attacks on Gaza, and warned that they may constitute war crimes.
Israeli attacks resulted in extensive civilian deaths and injuries, as well as large-scale destruction and damage to civilian objects. This includes governmental buildings, residential homes and apartment buildings, international humanitarian organizations, medical facilities, media offices, and roads connecting essential services such as hospitals.
The Palestinian Authority has welcomed the decision, saying it amounts to international recognition of Israel's systematic oppression and discrimination against the Palestinian people. The PA said this reality of apartheid and impunity can no longer be ignored. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has also hailed a UNHRC decision for investigation.
What happened in the Gaza Strip is a fully-fledged war crime that the world watched it happen on their television. Now we need a further step to be taken, which is to actually punish the occupation and take preventive steps so these crimes would not be repeated against our Palestinian people.
The United States, as Israel's number one supporter, has as usual regretted the Council's probe decision. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu also criticized what he called a shameful example of the Council's blatant anti-Israeli obsession. Tel Aviv said that it will not cooperate with the probe. Analysts say the investigation comes at a time when a number of reports are emerging holding Israel responsible for crimes of apartheid and persecution.
This is really a paralegal type of impact because it's compounding against the Israelis, because it comes just in the wake of a couple of reports declaring Israel responsible for the crime of apartheid and the crime of persecution.
The Israeli regime is also under investigation in the International Criminal Court over 2014 war crimes in Gaza, settlement activities in the occupied West Bank, and the brutal crackdown on anti-occupation Palestinian protesters. Despite international condemnations and calls for investigations over the past decades, Israel has been enjoying the backing of the United States and other Western countries to commit crimes against Palestinians without fearing the consequences. Many, including Arab countries, have also been turning a blind eye to the crimes, and some have even made efforts to normalize ties with Tel Aviv. It remains to be seen whether the result of the investigation will change anything substantial on the ground.
Now, so a senior official from Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says Israel's latest aggression on the Gaza Strip revealed the regime's security vulnerability.
The last confrontation indicated very, very clearly how the Israeli occupation is fragile, how the Israeli occupation is not immune from loss, from defeat, how the resistance can reach and can achieve a lost, a big success in defending Palestine.
Al-Zahar made the remarks during an exclusive interview with Press TV. He said the Israeli aggression shattered a false sense of security there. It also fostered unity between Palestinians living in the occupied territories and those in Gaza. That's what the Hamas official said. He added the onslaught exposed Israel as a criminal entity that commits crimes against innocent people and targets civilian facilities. Al-Zahar also hailed Iran for its continued support for resistance against Israel. Japan has extended a COVID-19 state of emergency in Tokyo and other areas less than 2 months before the Summer Olympics open.
Although the infections in Tokyo, Osaka, and other places are on a downward trend, the new case numbers are still high. In places like Osaka, hospitals continue to be under strain. Hokkaido and Okinawa are seeing continuous increases in case numbers, and due to such situations, we have decided on this extension.
The Japanese premier said the state of emergency will remain in place until June 20th. He said the next 3 weeks will be key to speeding up the vaccine rollout and countering a spike in infections. The state of emergency in the capital and 8 other prefectures had been scheduled to end on May the 31st. In recent days, Japan has seen a record number of COVID patients in critical condition. Concerns over new variants of the virus and a slow vaccination drive have prompted calls to cancel the Olympic Games scheduled for late July. The World Health Organization's director for Europe has expressed dissatisfaction with the continent's coronavirus vaccination rollout. He says the inoculation rate there is still too slow. Hans Kluge said the pandemic would not be over until at least 70% of people are vaccinated. He called on countries to speed up the inoculation drive. The European Union's vaccination campaign has been hampered by delays in vaccine production and deliveries. Reports say less than 17% of the EU's population has been fully vaccinated so far. The bloc is currently engaged in a legal battle against drug maker AstraZeneca over jab supplies. Elsewhere, Kluge voiced a concern about the higher transmission level of the new COVID strains, including the Indian and British variants. The Malaysian government has imposed a strict nationwide lockdown as the country is witnessing a dramatic surge in COVID-19 infections. The lockdown will take effect from Tuesday and remain in place for 2 weeks. On Friday, Malaysia logged nearly 8,300 new coronavirus cases in 24 hours. That broke the country's previous daily records for a fourth straight day. The surge has strained Malaysia's healthcare system as record numbers of patients have been hospitalized. Authorities blame the crisis on more infectious coronavirus variants. They've pledged to step up the vaccination campaign, which has been described as sluggish and chaotic by critics. Well, Tehran says the U.S. and Britain are trying to appease Israel by spinning the goals of the ongoing Vienna talks on the revival of the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. To discuss that further, we were earlier joined by our guests in the News Review program. Let's see what they had to say. Now, welcome everyone to the 2UP News Review program, where we get in-depth in one of the day's top stories. Now, Tehran says that the U.S. and Britain are trying to appease Israel by spinning the goals of the ongoing Vienna talks on the revival of the Iran nuclear deal.
To appease the sworn enemy of JCPOA, UK and U.S. foreign ministers spin goals of Vienna talks. Disappointing. The brutal Israeli regime you try to placate has done its utmost to torpedo the deal. Instead of eroding your credibility, focus on reviving the original deal, the only solution on the table.
Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman made the comments on his Twitter account, and it comes 2 days after the U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken said that his country will continue close consultation with Israel about any potential return to the deal. UK has also taken a similar stance, with Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab calling for a stronger deal with Iran. Now, the U.S. withdrew from the agreement in 2018 and reimposed sanctions, prompting remedial commitment cuts from Iran. Tehran says it will return to compliance with the accord once all U.S. sanctions are removed in a verifiable manner. And joining us now for this news review is Homa Lezgi, joining us from Vienna. Hello, and I'd like to welcome you to the program. Homa, we're going to start with you to get the latest. Go ahead.
Yes, as you said, these comments that have been made, or I should say the position that's been announced by the Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman, coming after some telling remarks from the U.S. Secretary of State following that press conference that we saw news of that earlier, where Benjamin Netanyahu was saying that he doesn't want the U.S. to go back to the original JCPOA because from the beginning they did not like that agreement and they did not want that agreement to be enforced. But practically on the face of it, although the JCPOA was implemented, Iran didn't, in effect, benefit from it. And in 2018, when the Trump administration withdrew, additional sanctions were imposed. The maximum pressure policy was imposed. But now, we also heard remarks in an interview that I was reading by Secretary Blinken, in which he says that if Iran returns to full compliance, we will do the same. This is something that Iran has time and again said in these talks, that we would only go back to full compliance after the U.S. has verifiably removed sanctions. Also, he said that we would also, in his remarks to Israeli media, if I'm not mistaken, said that the U.S. would also like to make this deal longer and stronger. Also, these issues that would be seen as excessive demands from the Iranian sides, because what Iran wants is a return to the agreement that was agreed upon back in 2015 and was implemented in 2016. The deadlines for that agreement are 2030 for most of the issues, including the level of enrichment, the stockpile of enriched uranium. But Mr. Blinken suggesting that the U.S. has plans to extend those deadlines, and also he was talking of engaging other issues when it comes to, in his words, Iran's problematic behavior in the region when it comes to Israel and the U.S. So these kinds of remarks, of course, coming at a time when the U.S. is engaged in the Vienna talks, of course, indirectly, not any direct talks taking place between Iran and the U.S., but just today we heard the news that there was a meeting between the other signatories and the U.S., and the Russian ambassador, Ulyanova, tweeted that they are reviewing implementation aspects of the agreement, which are at an advanced stage of elaboration. But these kinds of comments that are being made, we have to see if these are just meant for public consumption, for the media, because if they are actually statements that are real and are demands that are being put to Iran, there is not going to be much hope for a JCPOA revival, because these are considered Iran's red lines.
Thank you for joining us, and do stay safe. Homa Lezgi there joining us from Vienna. That's a wrap for the segment of your News Review program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Well, as we know, campaigning for the June 18th presidential election has commenced in Iran. My colleague Omid is on hand with us now with more election news. Omid?
Welcome to special coverage of Iran's 2021 presidential election. Thank you for joining us. Campaigning is underway for Iran's presidential election as the seven candidates vying for the top executive post lay out ideas and plans to settle national challenges. The candidates have started appearing on TV and radio channels as part of efforts to woo voters. The campaigns are expected to mainly go on through TV channels and social media platforms because of the pandemic. The Iranian Interior Ministry, which organizes the June 18 vote, has discouraged fanfare in the streets. However, campaign posters and banners of the candidates have already gone up in Tehran and other cities.
Saeed Jadidi is among the seven candidates approved by Iran's Constitutional Council to run for president. He says if elected president, his administration will try hard to make an economic leap. Jadidi has also pledged to resolve unemployment and create more jobs.
We have held over the past years numerous sessions with different teams, including experts, university professors, and successful managers. Following all those talks, we have come up with a plan by the name of employment. It calls for creating as many jobs as we can in accordance with the country's capabilities and requirements, and at least in organizations under the supervision of the president.
Mohsen Rezaei is another candidate approved by the Constitutional Council for the June presidential vote. The 66-year-old hopeful has pledged to focus on economy. He says he will bring economic stability in the first 3 months of his administration. Rezaei says in order for the goal to be achieved, he will present plans that will control and stabilize prices. Ebrahim Raisi, who is currently the judiciary chief, has promised to bring economic prosperity too. Raisi has also vowed to take measures to reduce the cost of treatment as part of his plan for the health sector.
It should be possible for the government to reduce the cost of treatment by up to 50% for families, and this is quite doable. Since the Iranian health staff are experienced, people do not have to worry about their health treatment.
Presidential candidate Alireza Zakani says the top priority of his administration will be the removal of U.S. sanctions that have directly targeted ordinary Iranians. Another candidate, Amir Hussein Ghazizadeh Hashemi, has also spoken of plans by his administration and has presented them in a three-volume booklet.
The first volume is about the causes and effects of the problems the country is facing to exactly find out where we have problems. The second volume offers solutions to the problems we detect. There has to be a paradigm shift in order to resolve them.
Mohsen Mehralizadeh, the other presidential candidate, says his future government's plan will include those working on a transparent economy. He says people should be informed of the results of economic activities and whether or not those activities produce any results. The reformist politician says he has drawn up a long-term political and social plan for governing the country. Abdel Nasser Hemmati is another candidate hoping to win the presidency. He is currently serving as the governor of Iran's central bank. Hemmati is strongly critical of the current situation and says his government will be the representative of the majority of people whose voices have not been heard.
The government that I'm planning to form is called the Administration of the Third Voice. Both principalists and reformists can be part of my future administration.
Hemmati says his main concern is economy and people's livelihood. He says he has drawn up a comprehensive plan and that his goals can be achieved through construction interaction, among other things. Iranians will go to the polls on June 18 to choose a new president for the next 4 years. Economy is a major issue because things have got hard for the Iranians in the past several years following the 2018 withdrawal of the U.S. from the nuclear deal and the reimposition of the sanctions that have hit Iran's economy.
And that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
A new study published in the scientific journal Environmental Research suggests the connection between an increase in the Earth's temperature and more stillbirths. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you, written by Matteo Rozza Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Climate Crisis May Lead to Rising Stillbirths. Stay tuned for more. Climate change is perhaps the greatest existential threat that humanity has ever faced. And as environmental research accumulates, we keep discovering unexpected side effects of making industrial civilization reliant on fossil fuels. The latest one, a likely link between global warming and increased numbers of stillbirths. A new study published in the scientific journal Environmental Research suggests a connection between an increase in the Earth's temperature and more stillbirths. Authors from the University of Queensland found that pregnant women who were exposed to extreme ambient temperatures during their pregnancy seemed to be at an increased risk of stillbirth, especially later in the pregnancy. Scholars at their School of Earth and Environmental Science and Mater Research Institute reviewed 12 studies with relevant data in their study. An estimated 17-19% of stillbirths are potentially attributable to chronic exposure to extreme hot and cold temperatures during pregnancy, the authors note. Climate change can have a multitude of impacts on an individual's health, especially among vulnerable populations, the research team behind the study told reporters by mail. For pregnant mothers, extreme weather events can impact access to antenatal services and increased risk of heat-related illnesses. Mothers living in low-resource settings are particularly vulnerable to these effects. In a press release regarding the study, environmental scientist Dr. Scott Lisk described how their conclusions suggest that marginalized populations, which already struggle disproportionately due to lack of resources, will be even harder hit as global temperatures rise and they suffer more miscarriages. More than 2 million stillbirths occur every year around the world, with the most occurring in low-resource settings, Dr. Lisk said in a press release. Not only are these poorer countries already affected disproportionately by stillbirths, they are now going to be disproportionately affected by climate change as well. If the link apparent in this research bears out upon further scrutiny, the majority of new stillbirths will occur invariably in the nations already suffering the most. The scholars emphasize that much additional work needs to be done to fully understand the science at play here. To fully understand the effects of maternal exposure to ambient temperatures and stillbirth, future studies should focus on the biological mechanisms involved and contributing factors in addition to improving measurement of ambient temperature exposure. Professor Vicky Felnari, Director of the Center of Research Excellence in Stillbirth, Silbeth, CRE, at Mater Research, said in the press release. In the meantime, we would encourage pregnant women to talk to their healthcare providers about staying safe during the cold days of winter and hot days of summer. The research team told reporters that they are interested in learning more about the ways our environment impacts stillbirth risks and chose to study ambient temperature exposure during pregnancy as an initial step. The NHMRC Stillbirth CRE research program addresses priorities across four major program areas, including improving stillbirth data to drive change and identifying new approaches to stillbirth prevention, they wrote to reporters. This review helped us to identify an important gap in data as well as highlighting a potential area where stillbirth risk could be improved in the future. The possible rise in stillbirth is only the latest in a series of red flags indicating that pollution and greenhouse gas emissions are making Earth less habitable. According to the World Wildlife Fund, the population sizes of mammals, birds, amphibians, reptiles, and fish have fallen by 68% since 1970, amounting to an unprecedented decline in Earth's biodiversity. Over the last two centuries, humans have destroyed one-third of the planet's forest cover and overfished one-third of the world's fish stocks. We also continue to churn out plastic products that clog up our oceans, clutter up our land, and contain chemicals that have been linked to ominously declining sperm counts.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
It takes less than a month to put a new face to the country. May the 11th saw presidential candidates registering with the Interior Ministry until May the 16th. And June the 18th will see ballots cast in Iran. Today we'll be looking at procedures filling the gap, the vetting of hopefuls, their election campaigns, where they come from, and what institutions have the clout to direct all the above into an acceptable future. I'm Leila Faromarz.
Thank you.
Presidential elections are held in Iran once every 4 years. The general process is that after the candidate's 5-day registration time frame with the Interior Ministry, their eligibility is reviewed within 10 days maximum by the constitutional vetting body known as the Guardian Council. This council has 12 members, 6 legal experts and 6 clerics. Any candidate winning at least 7 votes in favor is approved. Approved names are sent to the Interior Ministry. From the day names are finalized till 24 hours before election day, candidates can campaign. Elections are then held on a day with results to follow the next day. 592 people registered this year for the presidential race. After 10 days of vetting and consultations, the Guardian Council announced the approved candidates on May the 25th. The list is as follows. Ebrahim Raisi, Mohsen Rezai, Mohsen Mehralizadeh, Saeed Jalili, Ali Reza Zakani, Abdul Nasser Hemmati, Amir Hossein Ghazizadeh Hashemi. Now these candidates have 20 days to campaign for the presidential seat. Ms. Masuma Eptekar is current Vice President for Women and Family Affairs. We met her at the Vice Presidential Office for Women and Family Affairs.
We have always witnessed high voter turnout in Iran. Women and men have taken part in determining their future and destiny through elections. This is the strength of the Islamic Republic of Iran. But we've been facing a propaganda war against our country for the past several years now. This is part of the war waged against Iran, an economic war and a propaganda war. Our country has been facing fake news, a lot of slandering against the government.
Given JCPOA revival talks ongoing, one may expect a reformist hopeful to win the seat of president. Although many may be ready for a change of scene to principalist. But in Iran, election results have traditionally swung in favor of the dark horse or shadow candidate in the last few days running up to election day. Mr. Ghulam Reza Mesbahi Moghaddam is a former MP and Ayatollah, currently member to the Expediency Discernment Council and Assembly of Experts. We got to meet him at his office in Imam Sadegh University.
The events of 1997 showed us that when everybody believed Mr. Nader Nuri would win the ballots and that it wouldn't make a difference whether to vote or not, but we saw that it didn't happen. The candidate that garnered people's votes, Mr. Khatami, won the election with 20 million ballots against his rival with 7 million votes. Mr. Nader also congratulated Khatami on his victory. We have had this experience, and it can certainly happen again too. خاتمی با 20 میلیون رای رقیب خودش رو با 7 میلیون رای کنار گذاشت.
Having mentioned JCPOA considerations with the turnout and vote, it's worth mentioning that that nuclear deal is not Iran's only foreign policy factor for it to be a total determinant. With the JCPOA's failure to deliver, Iran struck a 25-year deal with China. Also, Iran is aware of a very partially exploited several hundred million strong regional market. Mr. Naghavi Hosseini is a former MP, well-versed with the law and eloquent in putting the country's political system into a legal and historical context. He gave us his time in a legal office of breathtaking elegance. He is currently member of the Front of Islamic Revolution Stability.
The principalists are in luck. This is the reality. There's a tendency toward principalists in the society because reformists and moderates can't be accountable for Mr. Rouhani's performance. Even reformist figures like Mr. Aref try to depict Mr. Rouhani as a placeholder president who isn't a reformist. They are right, of course, because we have known Mr. Rouhani and he hasn't had a reformist background. But anyway, the cabinet has been the cabinet of the reformists. Many reformist ministers were in this cabinet. That's why principalists are now critical of the two past cabinets and hold people accountable who call themselves reformists.
Serious presidential candidates tend to formally register as candidates a few hours prior to deadline for a position that will see them preside over the highest strategic decision-making body, as well as the country itself. That's the Supreme National Security Council. The constitutionally mandated composition of the council also, however, awards a seat at the table to each power of the state, judiciary and legislative, as well as executive. Strategic cabinet ministers and the leader of the revolution or his representative also each have a vote. The president, as chief of the executive, governs how things are done to manage and steer the country. But that's not unsupervised and at times even vetoed. The Supreme National Security Council prevailing policy orientation will be the policy of the Iranian state, not necessarily policy preferences of the president.
Do comment on the leader's words calling for a government that wants change. What would such a government look like?
The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has always emphasized on people's participation, presence, role, criticism and protests. It's important to note that his view is that people must have a permanent and active presence. His second view is that there should always be a change. There has to be a turnover in the country's elites. That we shouldn't repeat the past. This is something to be noted. If the elections are held and the same people with a different form win, the same people who have been in office for the past 40 years, we can't expect any change to come about. People are looking for a government that would bring about profound changes.
More than 59 million of Iran's roughly 85 million population are eligible to vote. Under 1.5 million of whom are first-time voters. People may vote either way for economic reform. They may vote for a reformist with a greater tendency for diplomacy and international relations, or for a principalist who can provide cover for reformists to come to terms with the U.S. and West, Western partners to the JCPOA, so that sanctions can be lifted off this country. That is drawing on accounts by analysts abroad, because looking at it from within Iran, the system is pretty unified on wanting talks to yield results, without, again, giving a mile to take an inch. The third scenario is that the turnout will be too low for reformists to stand a chance, looking at last year's parliamentary elections, whereby voter participation fell to 42%, a record low.
Plenty more to be said, but time to give others a chance for a word or two. So stay with me for a quick media review to see what other outlets have to say. And here it is in words. Shinhua Net points to the conditions for candidacy, some of which the government had a problem with, for example, the optimum age group. World Insight, spotlight on heavyweights in Iran's presidential race as betting begins. To exclude a large number of the individuals who register every 4 years as potential candidates with very basic or no qualifications, the Guardian Council on May the 5th approved an amendment to further clarify the criteria based on which it vets the potential candidates, according to the Council's official website. Orf, who heads the Interior Ministry's election headquarters, said the lower number of registrants for this year's election compared to the previous votes has proven that the Council's move to clarify the criteria has been effective in bringing greater rationality to the registration process's general atmosphere, the IRNA wrote. In the 12th and 11th elections, the number of the registered hopefuls stood at 1,636 and 686, respectively, Orf said. According to the amended criteria, hopefuls must be between 40 and 70 years of age, hold at least a master's degree or its equivalent, have work experience of at least 4 years in managerial posts, and with no criminal record. Analysts say the main chances of winning the vote could be of the principalist and reformist parties, the two main rival political camps in the country. Looking at oil price, would it make much difference to the U.S. really whether a reformist, a principalist or moderate gets in with the Iranian presidential elections? The U.S. shouldn't hold high hopes for a pro-West Iranian president. The U.S. and Iran have been engaged in on-off talks about the resuscitation of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, the nuclear deal, for some months now, following the U.S.'s unilateral withdrawal from the treaty in May 2018. So far, little progress has been made on any of the key issues involved on either side,
There are hopes in some quarters of the U.S. State Department that this data, in conjunction with the election in Iran on 18th June of a new president, will result in a softening of Tehran's stance towards accepting the tougher clauses that Washington wants to include in any new nuclear deal. These hopes are likely to come to nothing, though. There are those Iranian politicians that believe that more engagement with the West will get Iran more of what it wants than more engagement with Russia and China, certainly. And there are questions of Iranian sovereignty attached to that, but that is not an ideological difference, just an economic one. But at the core, all Iranian top officials believe in the mottos of the Islamic Revolution of 1979, which are independence, freedom, and Islamic Republic. So although they might have different approaches toward Iran's problems, at the end of the day, they all have a deep distrust for the U.S. The Star points to a new development on social media in the run-up to the elections. Iranians find their voices on Clubhouse ahead of poll. As Iran gears up for a presidential election, people from across the political spectrum are taking to the audio app Clubhouse as a rare forum for debate inside the country. Chat rooms have been sprouting up every day on the invitation-only social media platform, some of them attracting thousands of listeners. Politicians from opposing factions have found their way to the app, along with an array of analysts, journalists, and Iranians both at home and abroad. Clubhouse's main draw card is that it has created an opportunity for dialogue between people who could not bear talking to each other before, said Farid Modarresi, an analyst close to the moderate camp of incumbent President Hassan Rouhani. The hot topic on their lips has been the hopefuls who have been coming forward and registering to be candidates for the 18th June presidential election. In an editorial in April, the news agency Tasnim said Iran's foes could cause security, social and political problems for the country through Clubhouse. In an interview with AFP, the Guardian Council's spokesman Abbas Ali Katkhodai said the body saw Clubhouse as potentially constructive as long as no crimes were committed. That will be it for the news segment, but do stay tuned. More coming up. There has been a face-off between the Guardian Council and the presidency over candidacy criteria. President Rouhani ordered his interior ministry to ignore the Guardian Council proclamation because he believes it has no legal authority to impose new, more restrictive qualifying criteria on candidates. But the council said it would refuse to consider candidates as formally registered if they fail to provide all required documents, including a lack of criminal record and no history of dissent. And the new criteria have, by the way, been backed by 200 Iranian parliamentarians. Although candidates here like to stress they are independent, there's political currents in the background which they are either akin to or which back them up. To introduce the main currents participating in this year's elections, they are the current critical of the Rouhani government, that's Raisi, etc., the current aligned with the government, and the current supportive of the Rouhani government, which is reformists. This is not to forget independents running for office.
In a religious democracy, the people's votes are really influential and decisive. You have witnessed in the past elections, for example, that the whole electoral system was being managed and administered by a political faction, but someone from a rival party won the election. For instance, in 2005, when all the administrative bodies were supportive of Mr. Hashemi Rafsanjani, but people voted for Mr. Ahmadinejad. The same happened in 2013. This is a matter of pride.
In Talking Democracy, Mr. Naghavi Hosseini said why it's so important for a system to run on working political parties. Because Iran has hundreds of parties, but how functioning they are is another matter.
The fact that the person is elected but doesn't make good on his words afterwards goes back to the problem of not having a parties-based political system, because the candidate hasn't been backed by a party to be held accountable after winning the vote. The U.S. Democrats are accountable for the president's performance because it was the party that collected the votes. The president has won as a Democrat, but because the principle of parties hasn't been established well in Iran, the candidate feels free to do whatever he wants after taking office as president. It's because there's no party to admonish him.
592 candidates, including 40 women, had registered by May the 19th. I asked what gave the 40 women the confidence to apply as prospective presidential candidates this year.
This is the culmination of a series of policies that we've implemented that has been successful in terms of engaging women in the decision-making processes in the country. We started the beginning of this government 8 years ago. About 5% of the managers in the government of the Islamic Republic of Iran were women. Although it's stipulated in the constitution that women have no, there's no obstacle to women's advancement, Imam Khomeini, the leader, have never made any obstacle for women's engagement in politics or in running the affairs of the country. But there have been glass ceilings. What President Rouhani did was that he put forward a strategy, particularly from 2017, that is his second government. He set a quota that 30% of the managers appointed in this government have to be women.
What tends to happen in Iran is that candidates on each front tend to pull out in favor of the winning card closest to their camp.
It's important that candidates from the two rival political camps compete, even if it doesn't result in polarity of votes. But people have to be able to prefer one over the other. There has to be a meaningful ground for preference. We can say one of the candidates is good, but the other is better. Or I can remember there was a time that we said one of the candidates was bad, but the other was worse. So we need to do something so he wouldn't take over. What I believe is crucial is that people understand that our current economic and social situation isn't acceptable at all. Especially over the past 8 years, things haven't been improving, but even regressing. Of course, both domestic and foreign factors were involved, but proper management makes a difference.
To what extent would you say political factions in Iran have reached political maturity, having seen 4 decades of the revolution go by?
Certainly, political movements have gained the necessary maturity after some 40 years of activity in Iran. There are some occasions when they face problems and doubts, but it's not because they're not mature enough. There are other reasons for that. The main one is the lack of parties. We don't have large and relatively inclusive parties. They're too small.
Talking of parties, under Article 26 of the Constitution of Iran, the formation of parties, societies, political or professional associations, as well as religious societies, is permitted, provided they do not violate the principles of independence, freedom, national unity, the criteria of Islam, or the basis of the Islamic Republic. In the early years following the 1979 Islamic Revolution, political parties in this country were divided into right-wing and left-wing, basically in the economic sense. Today, most parties can be classed as principalist or reformist. These are 1990s adaptations of right-wing and left-wing. Then there are moderates, the incumbent Rouhani government, and independents, basically speaking. To move on to ideology or political agenda, principalists say politics and religion are inseparable. They support a minimized government role in the economy to the extent mentioned in the Constitution. They view the globalization of economy with skepticism, while putting special emphasis on retaining independence from foreign countries. Reformists, on the other hand, seek to execute the constitutional rights of the people and work toward enhancing political freedom. They opt for a promotion of interaction with the international community. As for the term moderates, it surfaced in 2013 with Hassan Rouhani's presidential election. Moderates are widely believed to be left-leaning. They advocate employing diplomacy and refraining from using harsh rhetoric.
The other end of the spectrum are reformists who believe in the principles of the Islamic Revolution, abide to the Constitution, but are very forward-looking in their policies. And they believe that we have to have a progressive approach when dealing with Islam, because Islam is a religion for all times, and we have to engage in a dialogue which should be constructive but also can be critical dialogue with our young generation to enable them to engage with the theoretical dimensions of the Islamic Revolution, to engage with some of the practical dimensions of what has happened all of these years. So this is what the reformists believe, and they believe that we need a constant reform of laws, of policy, of practices to be able to preserve the principles and the spirit of the Islamic Revolution.
A spectrum of political party colors being out there is no accident. Iran calls for diversity among candidates in upcoming presidential elections. But given this is a religious democracy in contrast to a Western liberal democracy with no title, I asked if that actually meant all walks of life in Iran will be covered by varied candidates and political parties.
It's always been like this. I mean, during elections in Iran, we've always had candidates from the two major political camps, the reformists and principalists. It would certainly be the case in the upcoming vote, too.
Can you compare political factions post-revolution to pre-revolution?
Political parties that were active before the revolution were Shah's puppets. We used to have the Iran Novin Party and the People's Party. Shah dissolved both and formed the Rastakhiz Party and called it the Singhal Party, saying to anyone who'd oppose it to take their passport, obtain a visa for another country and leave. There were no independent parties that relied on the people before the victory of Iran's Islamic Revolution.
It's not just the 13th presidential elections the country will be holding on June the 18th, but the 6th election for the city and village councils, as well as midterm elections for the Islamic Consultative Assembly or Parliament. Also, the Assembly of Experts elections will be held on the same day in some provinces. Western political pundits, the media, politicians, frequently criticize this country for not being a democracy in their eyes. But not much is being said about authoritarian Arab kingdoms in the region. Why they can't see a democracy in common between religious democracy and Western liberal democracy calls for an answer.
Because they don't see their interests and their profits in the independence and the strength of the Islamic Republic, because if the Islamic Republic of Iran proceeds as a successful model of an Islamic democracy in today's world, they're going to have a lot of problems with different entities which exist in the region, which are more or less dependent on Western governments for their economy or for their political system. They don't like to see a successful model of an independent state emerging.
That's it for today, but the story is only just beginning. Bye.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM, 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.